underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. George Saunders is considered one of the great masters of the short story, and now he has written his first novel. Lincoln in the Bardo is a novel that comes from the real-life death of Willie Lincoln, the 11-year-old son of Abe and Mary Lincoln, in 1862. Unfolding in a graveyard over the course of a single night and narrated by a chorus of voices, it is an exploration of struggle, death, love, and the powers of good and evil. George Saunders is a longtime contributor to The New Yorker and GQ. He teaches in the creative writing program at Syracuse University. In 2006, he was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship, and it is a great pleasure to welcome George Saunders back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. What an honor to have you on the program.
Well, Joe, thanks for having me back. Honor is mine.
I love this novel. I'm curious as to how you came to just the idea, that idea of, which I guess also comes out of another question that I would ask you about just the explanation of that term bardo.
This is one of those things where I heard an idea back in the 90s. It was just a story about Lincoln having gone into his son's crypt. He was so grief-stricken that he kind of snuck in there one night. So that just kind of followed me around for like 20 years. I kept thinking, I can't, it's too earnest. I can't do it. So finally, about 2012, I just was like, this idea has been coming back to you over and over. And every time I thought about it, I'd get that kind of sense of artistic excitement, So I kind of had a chat with myself, like, what is it that you are trying to do here by denying this idea? You don't want to be the guy who gets to the end of your life and hasn't tried this thing that's really calling to you. So I gave myself kind of a 3-month contract just to try it and see if I could get it going. And somewhere in there, in Buddhist epistemology, there's this idea of the bardo, which literally just means transitional state. And that would be the transition. Usually they talk about it to mean the transition between the moment of your death and whatever happens next, which in Buddhism would be. I love the title, Lincoln and the Bardo, and I kind of kept thinking, well, bardo, I don't really understand what it is. I'm kind of a baby Buddhist. So that would keep me, freshly reminded of the notion that whatever happens after you die, we're not going to know what it is. It's not like you're going to die and go, oh yeah, this is just as I expected. So aesthetically, to say it's the bardo meant it's not exactly purgatory. It's not exactly anything we know about. But one of the notions that you hear discussed around this bardo idea is that whatever your habitual state of mind is here could be supersized after death. Your neurotic habits and your mythological system. At the moment of death, it might be that just suddenly was, 1,000 times greater, which I guess it's terrifying, or it could be good news, depending on what's going on in your mind right now, Joe.
So Willie obviously is new. He has just passed and is in the bardo. This is new. However, many of the other voices, these other voices that are heard, have, I think, been around for a while, right? They have been in this state for quite some time.
Yeah, some 40 or 50 years, And that breaks with the actual Tibetan epistemology, which says that period is tightly confined. I think it's like 49 days. So there I kind of morphed over into more traditional ghost mythology, the idea that I read this great book called Ghosts by the last name of the writer is Holzer. And in there, he follows around just over the years hundreds of ghosts and brings mediums and stuff. And one of the really cool, odd things was that the first recourse mediums would use with these ghosts is just to try to get them to say what year they thought it was. So often a ghost would be like, I know it's 1880. And if they could just correct the person, sometimes show them a newspaper, then the person would kind of hit his ghostly hand to his forehead and go, doh, and go on. So I love the idea that if I died right now, I've still got a lot of stuff I'm thinking about, and I've still got a lot of unsatisfied desires and regrets and grudges. So I love the idea that that might be what kept a person hanging around a little longer than he should.
So as these voices come and go in the story, as you say, it's often an amplification of what their personalities were in life. How did you tell that and make that clear within the writing of the novel?
I find that, for me anyway, the best aesthetic approach is just to try not to suck. Try not to do that which is so, you know, banal or boring or that fills you, the writer, with dread, but to veer off of those things and try to find the stuff that's exciting and also sometimes even a little baffling, the stuff that you don't know how to manage. So in this book, I thought, okay, there's going to be ghosts, but I was honestly just trying to avoid the line like, you know, a ghostly presence drifted in from the west or something like that. I didn't want to use the word ghost. I didn't want a big drum roll when the ghosts were presenting. So I kind of stumbled on this way of, the book's really weird looking. There's blocks of text, and then the attribution comes after the text. So that's part of the sort of destabilization thing, is you don't really know who's talking for quite a while. And then that technique kind of led me to another one, which is to use actual historical text, to quote them verbatim, and then have their attributions at the end. So the hope was that, it's a little bit, I think the first 15 pages are a little difficult or a little challenging. So the hope is that, you know, you sort of pay your dues on those first 10 or 15 pages. And then that method of reading continues to teach itself to you. And then by the end of the book, my hope is you're kind of reading in a different mode than you've read before. And you're experiencing the benefit of having these characters just sort of show up and start talking into your ear, as opposed to being presented more traditionally, like so-and-so walks in and sits down. It's supposed to be, I think, a little more hallucinogenic, actually, is what I was kind of hoping for.
Oh, that's interesting, because that comes through, I think, very much so. I'm interested in that first 15 pages because there are these historical texts, and some go back a long way, although it wasn't until you mentioned Doris Kearns Goodwin that I realized that you hadn't made these up, that these were indeed real historical accounts.
Right. And, you know, what happened was I've been thinking about this story, like I said, for 20 years. And in that process, I'd kind of, you know, auto-novelized a lot of the historical incidents and could sort of imagine them in my head. So when I started writing the ghost, one thing that you find is a ghost is sort of, in some weird way, equivalent to a dream sequence. They're a little too easy. I had a writing teacher once tell me that you're allowed like 3 dream sequences in a career, and then you have to stop, you know. So I felt like at some point the story needed a little bit of historical grounding or factual grounding, just so the reader could tolerate more ghosts, basically. And I thought, well, how do I know all this history? And the answer came kind of quick, like, oh, you read about it. So I actually spent, you know, a lot of time just typing up these historical sources that I read, blocks of those, and then just kind of cutting them up with scissors and getting on the floor and rearranging them, trying to see if I could shape those things into something that was more novelistic. And there was this one day where I kind of spent the day doing this, and part of me was saying, you're going nuts. This isn't writing, man. This isn't even typing. It's just, you know, scissors and tape. But, you know, you get to an end of a day like that, and version 26 is a lot better than version 2. So then I was like, okay, so maybe part of this task called novelizing could be curating. You know, you're actually just trying to affect the reader by any means necessary.
George Saunders is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the novel is Lincoln in the Bardo. Let me ask a technical question, which is probably more for someone who has read the novel, but I am curious about it. You talk about the attribution. So if there is the historical text, you have the attribution there, as you would in most nonfiction and even when it appears in fiction. When it comes to the characters and the actual ghosts, if you will, their names come after the text, but they are all in there is no capitalization. And right. I'm curious as to why that was the case.
That is a great observation. It was really just to give you, the reader, one more little hint of who was who and what the world was. So the idea is, if there's a living person, it's, you know, done correctly. And if it's a dead person, they get all lowercase. And that kind of resonated with me a little bit. And one of the themes of the book is that these dead people, I didn't know they would feel this way, but as I wrote it, it became clear they did. They feel a little bit like second-class citizens. You know, they used to be in this beautiful realm that we're in, where you could, you know, feel and see and touch, and also you could influence things. And now they're still hanging in there, but their feelings are diminished. Their sensory stuff is gone. They're kind of dimly aware that the living don't see them and don't care about them. So it makes them feel kind of less. And I thought that kind of, you know, meshed with the lowercase thing. But it kind of just evolved because I had, in an early draft, I had, the big question was always, how do you make that transition from either the history to the ghosts or vice versa, the first time? So in an early draft of the book, it started with some letters from a Civil War soldier, just set up like normal Ken Burns kind of thing, you know, letter to his wife and then the attribution. And then about midway through the sequence of letters, his name goes lowercase. And we realize that he's been sort of writing these letters. Well, the first two letters are real. Then after he's killed on the battlefield, he continues to sort of compose the letters in his mind. So that was the first time I thought, well, how do I indicate that he's dead at this point? And I just, you know, flipped him into lowercase. So that ended up not sticking around, but I really liked the convention.
Also, just,
I like the technical questions, by the way.
Oh, okay, good, because I have a couple of them. The other one is, was there a conscious decision? Because if we were to read a play, the name would come first and then the text, but you have the text and then the name. So was that a conscious decision or did that just happen naturally?
Well, both, because I actually, there was many years ago, I tried another graveyard novel, didn't have Lincoln in it. And in there, the inspiration was basically, it was the early days of chat lines. And I just loved the way that looked, where we'd say, Joe Donahue, and then there'd be all this text, and then I would interrupt you, and, you know, I'd ask you something, and the answer wouldn't show up for two pages. And I just loved the way that looked on the page. So in that book, which never got finished, the attributions were at the top. And in the early drafts of this one, they were at the top. But, you know, it's funny. I think art gets made on a really interesting level, which is about subtle opinions that the artist has. And it's just almost like, you know, when you go to the eye doctor and they say, is this better or that better? I think an artist's job is partly to be really committed to those micro opinions. And in this case, I just didn't like that the ghost attributions were at the top and the historical ones were at the bottom. It somehow just didn't seem graceful to me. It seemed almost to underscore too much the ghosts. And so I just thought, well, I'm going to move that to the bottom. It's going to be a little harder for a reader, but I think the payoff's going to be worth it because then the whole book has one format. And we can go back and forth really naturally without that kind of little hiccup in the reader's perception, you know. But then it also, you know, it also makes it a little confusing, which in the end, I think I'm good with it because the part of the danger of writing about the afterlife is that you, the writer, control it too much and you make it too much like some mythological version that we all know about. And I thought part of the fun was to say, yeah, this is death, but it's not like we think about death. It's not, you know, like in The Princess Bride, I do not think you know what I don't think it means what you think it means.
So when words are either misspelled or they're a phonetic spelling, that changes from character to character. Was that something that you wanted to try out, or did you know what characters you wanted to use that with?
It just evolved. You know, you'd be doing somebody's voice, and you'd notice that they're using, three ampersands per line. And then I think the next time they showed up, I would just go back and go, well, yeah, oh, okay, that's how he talks. And then one of the other interesting conventions is that, I mean, the convention is that when we, quote-unquote, hear a ghost, what we're actually doing is we're seeing the way that ghost would have written in life. So that was fun to discover because it gave a method by which you could theoretically make a whole bunch of different voices. You know, you could just, with subtle, almost typographical attention, you could sort of just do a little wink to the reader. So that was part of the fun, was to try to find as many different variations of that as I could, and to almost like get right on the border where I was asking myself, okay, would an intelligent reader notice this? And maybe not consciously, but even just in the unconscious glide through the lines, would a serious reader feel that person A and person B were talking differently if person B misuses a semicolon? The early returns are people actually do pick up on that in a kind of a hazy way, which is fun.
There's one character that comes early in the novel, one character, Elise Trainer, who says, but your ancient friends who come to ogle and mock me, and then the line goes on. F-U-K. Your is YR. It's almost like you're reading a text in some senses.
Yeah.
And then ancient is A-N-S-H-I-E-N-T, friends, F-R-E-N-D-S. So again, that comes with that character, but it's also really fascinating because you think you're reading fairly steadily and then you have to stop and say, oh, this is how I'm going to read for this particular character.
Yes, exactly. And one of the other opportunities it gives you, and this is true in her case, One of the ideas that in this realm, everybody's very, very fragile. You know, they're hanging in by their, just by the skin of their teeth. And that particular character has been there too long, and she's suffering almost like sort of demonic symptoms. So what you could do is you could even vary the spelling and typography within a passage. So in that one, she starts out okay, and then as she gets more heated, her spelling degrades, you know. So it was really fun to try to find the different, what do you call them, like fader switches. You know, you create a text, and after about four or five pages, like, okay, so I've made these opportunities. Of course, you also make constraints that you have to work within. So maybe for me, the big revelation of writing a novel for the first time was how many fader switches you get presented with and how, over the course of four or five years, how well acquainted you get with them. It's really like maybe driving a really, really nice car. It's got a lot of nuances that you can control.
Talk a little bit about what you consider to be the main characters, the characters who have a presence throughout the novel. There's some that come and go, and then we never hear from them again, but there are those core characters that are throughout the novel.
Yeah, it's funny. I think I kind of unconsciously mimicked The Wizard of Oz, because there's three. There's a guy, Volman, and there's a guy, Bevins, and there's a Reverend. Those are like the three sort of Scarecrow, Tin Man, Lion, and then Willie is sort of Dorothy, I guess. But so they were the three ghosts who'd been there quite a long time, and were kind of, I imagine them being a little bit like, you know, the guys you meet in a bar who are there too long, you know, and they don't really want to go anywhere else. And so they kind of, at first, resist Willie, and then they kind of caretake him. And then, of course, Lincoln, who that was one of the daunting things was, you know, somebody says, write a book about Lincoln. Like, no, I'll write a book about Jesus. Or, you know, it's really tough. But then, to try to say, well, all right, is there a way that I could approach that technically that might give us a different feeling about Lincoln? And one of the answers there was you could sort of fragment it. He's really only seen, I think, four times or something like that. And every time, he never gets a direct line. He's just quiet. But one of the conventions of the book is that these ghosts can, when they occupy or pass through a living person, they sort of get access to that person's thought stream. So we hear him there. So that meant you were always seeing him briefly at specific moments, kind of at an odd angle, which is an interesting challenge too.
George Saunders is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. Being a short story writer for as long as you have been, has there always been pressure on you to write a novel?
Not really. There were a lot of people asking if there was pressure, which is a form of pressure in some way. I tried it when I was young. Actually, we were living in Albany, and I went to a wedding in Mexico and came back and thought, I said to my wife, this is going to be great. I got it. I'm going to write this novel. So I went into this frenzy for 7 months or a year maybe, and produce this big book that, you know, it's in our house. It's kind of a standing joke, but it was called, to give you an idea, it was called La Boda de Eduardo, which means like Ed's wedding or something like that. And, you know, I gave it to my wife, and she got about six pages in and was just like, no, no, no. So that was very costly. You know, it scared me off of novels for a long time. And then I started writing stories, and they're so hard and so beautiful. And I really feel like everything I wanted to do artistically, I'll do in stories. But this particular one just got under my skin, and I went into it kind of advisedly, like, all right, beware of NBS, novel bloat syndrome. You know, just don't let that happen. And I just kind of tried to keep a lid on it, you know. And at some point, like page 60 or 70, I'm like, well, okay, you know, if you insist, then we'll try to do this. But it's, you know, it's funny. It says novel on the cover, but it's pretty weird. I'm not sure I'm not sure it really would. Although I guess a novel is a long work of prose that has something wrong with it. So that, and it qualifies by that standard.
I like that explanation. That's a great descriptor. When it comes to the idea, of course, I'm certainly not unique in making this observation, but I mean, the first thing that came to me when I realized what you were doing is that this is so our town-ish. You mentioned Ken Burns, and there's certainly that too. But yes, that idea of here we are in the graveyard and these voices are speaking to us.
Yeah, what was funny was I was weirdly educated, so I never read that. I never read it. I knew what it was vaguely. But so then I got about halfway into the book. I'm like, geez, I better look, you know, better read that and make sure I'm not. But then it felt different enough. But one of the cool things about this book was that as I worked on it, kind of on its own terms, it started to remind me of other things in a nice way. Literally, I was, again, about a third into it, and I said, oh, yeah, this is just like the Ken Burns thing. And I thought, that's great, because if a book has so much over weirdness and difficulty like this one does, then you always want to be trying to throw a rope to anybody to get in. So if somebody, you know, is at the point of despairing and not understanding the book, and they go, oh, yeah, it's like the Ken Burns thing, great. If they feel, yeah, it's like The Wizard of Oz, great. If they feel like Our Town or I think Spoon River Anthology, another one I haven't read. But So I think that's one of the tricks. I felt like if you want to do something kind of weird, and the reason you want to do something weird is because you feel like it could be extraordinarily beautiful. There's no other good reason to do it, not for the sake of being weird. But if you find yourself needing to do something weird, then I think you can be kind of a good Samaritan to your reader and try to help her along in whatever way you can. And I think certainly like invoking familiar tropes is one way to do it. And then hopefully you put your own spin on the tropes. But, you know, A Christmas Carol I had in mind for sure. Sure. Maybe like Spirited Away, something like that. So that was a nice thing to feel like instead of, sometimes with my stories, I felt like I was kind of on a lonely road, you know, trying to do something. And when I would try to throw that rope, there wasn't much to throw. But in this one, it felt like, oh yeah, this I could actually see anybody who's a happy reader with a little bit of gumption could find their way into this one, I think. I hope.
There are 166 characters, I believe, in the book, in the story. And for the audio version, you got 146 different voices to do this, including there's some people that work for the publishing company. You have friends, you have family, but you also have Nick Offerman, you have his wife Megan Mullally, Lena Dunham, David Sedaris does a beautiful job, Jeffrey Tambor, Don Cheadle, and the list goes on, Susan Sarandon. It's really quite remarkable. I read the novel when it was first put out in Galley and then listened to it when it came out in the audio, and you get two very different experiences.
Yeah, they are different, aren't they? Yeah. That was actually the brainchild of this wonderful woman named Kelly Gilday, who's a producer for Random House. And I'd finished the book. She emailed me to say, you know, when can you do the audiobook? And I just got this feeling like, oh my God, I can't. I can do like three voices. You know, I can do like a duck, you know, an old guy and a guy from Brooklyn. And so I thought, oh, it's going to be so tedious for me to just either be doing my same old South Side of Chicago nasal accent, or to be, you know, trying to do some kind of Southern voice, you know. So I said, can we do something else? Can we get into, you know, separate narrators? And she just was on it. And she said, you know what we can do? Why don't we have the goal of trying to get a different speaker for every 166, the 166 speeches? And she had at some point a spreadsheet with, you know, how many males, how many females, region, and all that kind of stuff. So she really just went off and did it. And I've got everybody. It's for me to listen to it is really lovely because I'll suddenly go, oh, my mom, you know, or oh, sure, that's my high school teacher, you know. But it kind of, you know, also it kind of fit the, for me anyway, I you know, I'm at a point in my life, and maybe we all are with this political situation where I have never had the kind of fondness for this country or despair that I have now. And to be coming to the end of this project and go, oh, you just wrote a love poem to, you know, the sort of ideal America, and then to have the chance to have this kind of community art project, you know, where you listen to the audiobook and there's more voices than any one person could ever do, you know, from every region and just everything. So that's kind of, it reminded me of that Whitman line, you know, I hear America singing. It's really, apart from the, you know, the quality of the low quality of the writing, the sound of those voices is really, really magnificent.
So as we wrap this up, I must ask you what I think is the obvious question, which is, next up for you, are you looking at the short story form, or are you fascinated by this novelistic form and something that you would like to do again?
Yeah, I really was fascinated with it, but I think I'm going to go back to my basic mantra, which is try not to know. You know, like I don't have anything in progress right now, so I'm just going to show up whenever I get off this tour and just see what appeals. And I'm going to be inclined to write stories because that was always what I loved. And God knows, I tried to make this a story, you know, and I almost kind of vetted it for a while. So I think I'll just go back to the same old approach and see what happens.
George Saunders' latest is Lincoln in the Bardo. It's published by Random House. George, it's a great pleasure and an honor to have you on the program. And again, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the work.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Great pleasure. Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.